KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about his latest story for the paper. It's called Supreme Court Rules Arresting, Citing People for Not Having Shelter is Constitutional. Supreme Court overturns ruling in Oregon case, decides criminalizing homeless residents for sleeping outside isn't cruel or unusual. Hey, Jeremiah, thanks for being here.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
So the Supreme Court decision in Grants Pass v. Johnson is the talk of the town, and you were actually there at the Supreme Court in D.C. when this case was being heard, so I'm eager to hear your thoughts on all of this. Let's break it down. What did the Supreme Court decide on Friday?
Yeah, so essentially the Supreme Court decided that it is okay for cities to level civil and criminal penalties against people who have no other place to go. A bit more hyperbolic version of that same statement is that it's punishing people because they have no other place to go. That's not so far off. I mean, this decision does really impact the way that cities are expected to respond to homelessness in their communities. And the court essentially ruled that the Ninth Circuit Court decision from a couple of years ago went too far in saying that Grants Pass ordinances leveling these penalties against people who are homeless violated the Eighth Amendment. So the court disagreed. They overturned that. And generally in the Ninth Circuit now, cities are able to punish people for their poverty.
So this was a 6-3 ruling, the conservative justices having the majority there. What was their reasoning? How did they support this decision that they made?
To some extent, this just comes back to a states' rights thing, as you might expect. Gorsuch wrote the opinion of the court and essentially just said that the Constitution's Eighth Amendment serves many important functions, but it does not authorize federal judges to wrest those rights and responsibilities from the American people. They argue, since Grants Pass is not punishing the status of being homeless, but rather the conduct associated with homelessness, that's something that Grants Pass gets to decide, and it's something that they say other jurisdictions can decide to do or not do if they choose to not punish people. But that's something that's better left to policymakers rather than the court.
What was the response in the dissent from the other three justices?
Well, I think the most powerful one is like really quite simple, which is Justice Sotomayor saying that sleeping is an essential human function and not a crime. Grants Pass had made it literally impossible for people who don't have another place to go to exist within the city limits or use a blanket to cover themselves, in the cold. And essentially it came down to that punishing, people who don't have a home is sort of the point here. Grants Pass does not punish babies. That's something that Sotomayor said in oral arguments too. Like, Grants Pass doesn't punish babies who have a blanket over them when they're in the parks. It literally only punishes homeless people. So punishing on housing status is something that seems to be cruel and unusual, at least to Kagan and Brown Jackson and Sotomayor, but the other three justices decided otherwise.
This case didn't even reach some of the questions before it, including whether the Grants Pass ordinances violate the excessive fines clause or the due process clause. Can you touch on that aspect? Where does that leave things if they didn't reach those issues?
The original case was filed in 2018, just a few weeks after the Martin v. Boise decision came down. It's worth noting the court effectively reversed Martin v. Boise too, which says that people can't be punished if there isn't adequate shelter for them within those city limits. So that original case had actually multiple complaints. The one that the court actually addressed was the cruel and unusual punishments clause of the Eighth Amendment, but it actually didn't say anything about the Due Process Clause, Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments, and the Excessive Fines Clause. So this complaint was saying that since Grants Pass is handing out these fines of $295, which go up to $537, they kick people out of parks. If people are kicked out of parks and they are found there, even though they have no other place to go, they can receive a $1,250 fine. That's the excessive fines argument. And also, by the time people are actually kicked out of a park, whether or not they have due process is, I guess it's not much of an open question, but like, if people are kicked out of parks, they've already been punished. And so that's the argument of this case. The court didn't decide on any of that stuff. So there may be still some future litigation here based on, you know, other parts of the Constitution.
You mentioned this earlier, that the argument that was being presented to the court, that this kind of these laws that Grants Pass had in place could not be constitutional, was this issue of status versus conduct, which dates back to other case law that goes back to the 60s, having to do with someone who was addicted to drugs and could they be punished just because they're addicted to drugs. Now, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a concurring opinion kind of questioning that, if I understand rightly. Can you explain sort of what the consequence of that is?
Yeah, just to reiterate that, this Grants Pass case is really rooted in this argument. Robinson has cited over and over again. It's rooted in this argument that homelessness is a status, something a person cannot avoid. And that is a really important precedent, because it says that if you can't punish a person based on status, then a person is protected from things that they cannot help. In the courtroom, there was a bit of a discussion about this, and Thomas was really the only one who seemed keen on the idea of overturning Robinson. A few other people, Amy Coney Barrett, said, "I'm not suggesting we overturn Robinson explicitly." But yeah, Thomas did decide, he doesn't have to do this, but he issued this concurring opinion saying that he believed Robinson is wrongly decided and that a future case could be brought that would challenge that. The implications of that are pretty broad. The idea that you could punish somebody based on something that they can't help is pretty terrifying. Of course, there are like protected classes in the United States based on race, sex, sexual preference and stuff. So for now, that might be safe, but that certainly seems like one of the pillars that might fall first if they were going to start punishing people based on the way that they're born.
Well, and this case comes out of Oregon, and immediately the question is, how does that impact us here at home now that this court case has been decided at the highest level?
The Oregon legislature, it went into effect in July 2023, but the Oregon legislature passed ORS 195-530, which required, it effectively codified Martin v. Boise. So it requires city ordinances regulating survival activities to be objectively reasonable with regard to people experiencing homelessness. So things aren't expected to change in Oregon very quickly because there is this law that technically protects people. That even is cited in these Supreme Court documents. But there has been a bit of a backlash to that because elected politicians have not been historically great at doing the things necessary for resolving the homelessness crisis. They've instead opted to blame essentially anyone else. It was judges for a while. It was lawyers for a while. You know, the Ninth Circuit Court. And now it's this pesky little law that protects homeless residents from being punished for being homeless. So it's expected to kind of not change here on a legal basis. But at the same time, a court saying that it's not cruel and unusual to punish people in poverty certainly opens up a lot of doors for harassment, be it from neighbors, some park watch groups that exist in Grants Pass or the police, you know. There's kind of a real world implication there versus the legal reality.
What have elected officials around Oregon been saying in response to this ruling?
There's been a not very broad window of responses here, but you know, kind of on the further right, more conservative, the House Republicans from the Oregon legislature issued a statement saying that we need to go after ORS 195-530 because that's the thing that's standing in the way, that doesn't give law enforcement the tools that it needs. You know, the House leader said that this is what conservative governance looks like. And then here in Portland, Commissioner Renee Gonzalez is saying that the dark days of the Ninth Circuit's decision, you know, are finally over. And he, you know, also believes that they need to go after that law. I will say, Governor Kotek, you know, this was passed when she was the Speaker of the House, that state law. And she issued a statement saying that she's more focused on affordable housing, the things that actually work to resolve homelessness. It was a bit of a tepid response. She did not say she would veto any legislation that would, you know, if they passed something that actually challenged that state law or overturned that state law. So it's a bit up in the air. And, you know, it kind of ranges from, you know, on one side, you know, conservatives really saying we need to go after this law, and then Democrats sort of not saying anything about the law.
What is being said at the Multnomah County level?
Yeah, Jessica Vega Peterson essentially said, you know, similar thing, that there's a lot of work to do to solve homelessness. And, you know, some of the Democrats seem to understand that regardless of punishing people, the housing crisis needs to be solved if homelessness is going to be solved. So that was, again, her focus, very similar to Governor Kotek's. And, you know, that comes in the context of the city and the state. You know, speaking of the city, Mayor Wheeler released one that said that he supported a robust discussion in the legislature about whether or not cities have the tools that they need to solve this. So this is all in the context of a new camping ban in the city and a new intergovernmental agreement with Multnomah County and the city. So, you know, it remains to be seen, but at least for now, there's a state law that protects people.
I want to also ask about Grants Pass, which is the city that is at the center of this whole issue. You spent some time there in your reporting as well. What does this mean for Grants Pass itself?
Grants Pass is under the same state law as everyone else. So, and that is essentially under the decision, a little bit more vague version of the Martin v. Boise decision. So, you know, they know. I talked to Cassie Leach, who runs the Mint navigation team that goes into parks and helps people, takes people to appointments, offers health care to people who don't have access to it otherwise. And she told me that, you know, she told me a few months ago that there was sort of a alignment that was happening where people were starting to recognize that they have to solve this crisis. They have to have emergency shelter for people, that which they have historically not had, and they have to offer resources to people, and they need to build more affordable housing. So she is quite disappointed, but is at the center of a lot of these discussions and seems to have some optimism. That's something that I actually get from, you know, across the country. I think it's a catalyzing moment for people who understand what it takes to resolve homelessness, and those things are somewhat clear to some people and somewhat less clear to others. But regardless, you know, a lot of people are doing the work to actually resolve this thing in the long run.
What do you hope readers and listeners take away from this story?
This is a really difficult decision to stomach. People on all sides of this issue want to see homelessness go away. Particularly visible homelessness is something that a lot of people are up in arms about. Criminalizing people who don't have other options doesn't work. It won't work in the future. And doing the actual work of getting people into housing, this is an affordable housing crisis. We had a coronavirus pandemic in 2020 that, you know, really made a lot of difficult things for a lot of different people. And, you know, this is a result of that stuff, and we know what it takes to resolve it. Decisions like this do nothing but exacerbate the issue. And we'll probably wake up in a few years and be a little bit disappointed about how much worse things have gotten because of this ruling.
If our listeners are interested in reading your work for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can support vendors by buying a paper. They're in your neighborhood, and they accept cash, Venmo, and tips. We print every week, and it comes out on Wednesdays. You can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't touch on?
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Jeremiah. I appreciate it. That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest story. It's called Supreme Court Rules Arresting, Citing People for Not Having Shelter is Constitutional. More information on that story is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. In November, Portlanders will have a new election method before them to help decide the composition of the new city council. It's ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting was part of a suite of changes in the charter reform that was passed in 2022. Ranked choice voting represents a pretty big shift from how voters are filling out their ballots normally, so we're here to learn some more about it. I spoke with Grace Ramsey with Democracy Rising. She's a national expert in ranked choice voting, and we're going to go more into what RCV is all about. Welcome to the show, Grace.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here.
I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Let's start with a little bit of primer here, since, you know, this is a new issue for a lot of our listeners. What is ranked choice voting?
Yeah, so ranked choice voting, it's kind of in the name. So voters rank their choices, right? But let's think of how kind of a typical election that we think of works. You look at the list of candidates, you either pick your favorite or pick the one that you like but has the best chance of winning. You fill in that bubble, that's it, right? And you just really hope that they do well. With ranked choice voting, it's a little bit more involved than that, right? We get to ask voters their preferences in a more profound way or a more nuanced way, I guess. And so instead of just picking that one candidate and hoping they do well, voters get to rank their choices. You get to pick that favorite candidate that you have, but you also get to think, okay, so if that candidate doesn't have enough support to be in the running, who's my backup choice, right? So you have those choices that you can rank for those candidates.
Well, I know that you have helped implement ranked choice voting in different cities and states around the country. How do those different systems differ from each other? As in, how many are you allowed to rank? Or how does that kind of thing shake out?
You know, you don't want to necessarily say every city is a snowflake, but they kind of are. Every state, every city has different ways of doing things. So it's varied a lot from different places. The nice thing is, for voters, the process is essentially the same. You pick your favorite candidate, mark them as your first choice, pick your next favorite candidate, mark them as your second choice, and so on. But let's see. So I got my start in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where they use ranked choice voting, but they only use it for one person at a time. So that's a slight difference, right? So here, the way Portlanders are going to use ranked choice voting to elect mayor and auditor, that would be across the board in Minneapolis. Whereas here, you all are electing three council members from each of the four geographic districts. So I'm biased in both directions, right? Of Minneapolis is where I learned about this and really feels like kind of where I became aware of that we could do democracy differently. Whereas I think the system that Portland is implementing is really cool, and I'm really excited about it.
So, right, you rank your choices, mm-hmm. and it's exciting because it's more expansive than two, or sort of, you know, bargaining with who is most likely to win that most matches me, right? What happens to those votes after they're cast?
Sure. So it works a little differently depending on which elections we're talking about. So let's start by just talking about if we are electing mayor or auditor, where we only have one person. So the way that you win in a ranked choice voting election when you're just electing one person is you need to earn more than half of the votes, because only one person can do that, right? If two people have more than half, something has gone wrong. And so what we do is we start by only looking at voters' first choices. Those backup choices on your ballot, we're not looking at them at all. And if somebody has more than half of the votes, they win. We're done. But the part about ranked choice voting that's very cool, and let's also think about that in like larger election contexts, right? There are a ton of elections that we have where when we look at voters' choices, nobody has more than half of the votes, right? And so whoever has the most wins, and then we're done. And that could mean a lot of people aren't represented in that election or in who's going to be in office. So with ranked choice voting, we take it a step further. If no one has more than half of the votes, we eliminate the candidate with the least amount of support. And so that candidate, you know, probably gave it a great effort, but for one reason or another, just wasn't really pulling a lot of support from the community. We eliminate that candidate, and the voters who ranked that candidate as that first choice would have their vote instantly go to their next choice. And then we repeat where we look and see if anybody has more than half of the votes. If not, we eliminate the next candidate with the fewest votes, and the same process happens, and we keep going until we have someone win with more than half of the votes, until somebody passes that sort of finish line. And that way we build consensus within the electorate. And for city council, it works the exact same way for voters, but a little bit differently in terms of how the votes are counted. So just like we said, only one person can get more than half of the votes when we're just electing one person, like mayor or auditor. If we're electing more than one person, the number of votes somebody needs to win changes. So for instance, with Portland, each district will be electing 3 members of the city council. And so the question becomes, how many votes can 3 candidates all get that 4 can't? And that number is 25%, a quarter of the votes. Because if 4 people have more than a quarter of the vote, something has gone wrong, right? We have too many votes accounted for. So 25%, or just over 25%, is the number of votes people need to win. And so we start the exact same way. Voters rank those candidates in order of choice, and we only look at first choices when we start. If 3 candidates have more than 25% of the vote, we're done. Everybody's elected. If they don't, then we go into that process again, right? And the slight difference with the city council races that I think is really, it's just where this gets so cool, in my opinion, as an elections nerd a little bit, but also as somebody who wishes I had something like this where I live. So if a candidate has a ton of votes, more than they need to be elected, we don't want to punish a lot of voters for feeling the same way. If you're electing 3 seats and there's a huge group of you that feel really similar about a candidate's platform or the issues that are running this election, if there's a huge, huge group of you, we don't want to limit you to one of those seats. If maybe your strength in the electorate probably entitles you to more than one of those seats, right? And so what happens is if a candidate gets way more votes than they need, each of those voters would have a small portion, a tiny little portion, each of those voters go to their next choice on the ballot. So that is why this is a proportional system. That's why you've heard that, is that voters are getting their share of representation in proportion to their strength in the electorate. So if a candidate overperforms, again, each of those voters gets a little bit of their vote to go to their next choice. The way I think about it is my vote is a dollar. And let's say a candidate is so popular, they only needed 90 cents of my dollar to get elected. And so in a ranked choice system like this, I get to spend my 10 cents that's left over on another candidate. It's not my whole vote, but it's a little bit of my vote because that candidate just didn't need all of it. So we do that, and then we check, you know, do we have all of our seats filled? And if not, we repeat that process of eliminating the candidate with the fewest votes. Those voters instantly have their vote go to their next choice, and then we keep that process going until we have our 3 seats.
Thank you for explaining that. I've heard some criticism or maybe confusion recently about how it becomes proportional, right? Mm-hmm. And concerns that, you know, only 25% of a district is able to put a person on city council.
Can
yeah,
I jump
please.
In there? I would challenge to think of that from the other perspective. 75% of voters in those districts will have a say in who represents them, right? If 3 candidates are getting 25% of the vote, 75% of voters get a say. And so it is different, right? Having that level be different. But also, let's think about other races that we've seen in our normal elections where there's tons of candidates and somebody can win with 14%, right? So every election has its things, right? Like our status quo, you may not be surprised, I don't always love in a lot of situations because I don't think it always supports the breadth of choice that voters are looking for. And so this system answers for that and makes sure that we're representing people in proportion to their strength in the electorate.
I'm interested in your perspective on, you know, this being adopted in other places. Have you noticed common themes about how it's received?
Yeah. I think you said before that there are concerns, and I want to stress that, like, change is difficult, and people being concerned for their community is a good thing, right? Like, people saying, like, hey, I want to make sure that we do this right, and I want to make sure that people get this, I think that's great. And for people who feel that way, I am hoping that they engage in voter education in this cycle. I hope they talk with folks and their neighbors and make sure that they're ready to go. I think change is difficult on every level whenever you change something, right? If there's a big new program being rolled out at the city level, if there's new services available to folks, there's always work that needs to be done to make that happen. And so what I've found is across the country, people are really invested in that work, however it gets done. And so that's what I do. And I've always been really excited to do so. And it's really fulfilling. But I think that's what we sense is there's some people who are really excited for something new. And then there are some people who are saying, okay, cool, you said all of these things are great. Let's see how this goes. And that's where I love when we have, you know, voter education efforts in these places, because we get to take those folks, say, what are your concerns? We want to hear you out. We want to make sure that we are aware of what's going on, but also, like, join us. Let's go talk to people about it. Let's go make sure that we're getting ahead of anything that's concerning folks. And I think over the years, you know, I've been educating voters about ranked choice voting specifically for 10 years now. I can understand how for some folks nationally, there's a real sense of frustration. But my 10 years of doing this has given me real faith in voters, and that when given the opportunity, they step up to the plate. And the energy that I get from folks in doing this work is pretty amazing. And even when there are concerns, those are often the people that I'm most excited to work with, because it makes us better.
And I think that there's, like, a balance to strike there, right? Of, because some of the concerns sometimes sound like voters are too stupid to be able to figure out what they really want. And certainly there's this voter education piece to mm-hmm. explain, hey, here's how to, for your fullest potential, for your fullest democratic participation, here's how to do X, Y, and Z, versus assuming too little of people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I as a rule, never underestimate voters. I mean, I think, and at the same time, give people the resources to empower themselves, right? So what we've found over the years is when a voter sees a ballot, it tends to be intuitive. That's not necessarily all the time. We all have, you know, there's so many different learning styles, there's so many different things. So we want to be attentive to that in how we educate voters. But one thing that I think gets looked over sometimes when I hear that folks are concerned about voters not getting it, is this thought process is actually one we use all the time. The example I like to give is I have a nephew who's in high school, and in a couple of years, he's going to have to start making some choices about what comes after high school. And he's going to have to think of his options, his candidates, if you will. So it could be a 4-year program. It could be a 2-year program. It could be an apprenticeship. It could be taking a year off. Yeah, right. You know, there's all these options in front of him. And what he's going to need to do is decide, what's my optimal choice? What is the thing I really, really want to do? Now, what if maybe a test score doesn't get me there? What if something goes wrong and that can't be what I do? What's my backup choice, right? If I can't have that perfect. And, like, that is a real life, tough, impactful decision. And realistically, that is ranked choice thinking in action. And so I think often what my job is to take it out of politics so that folks know that they think this way regularly enough to put it back in.
Well, we just had our primary election in Oregon, no ranked choice voting on that ballot, at least in Multnomah County. For voters next fall, are there different things they'll need to prepare in order to vote with full information?
I think so. It's knowing what's on your ballot, right? And that's any election, any time, regardless of the system being used, is hopefully knowing what races are on there and what you need to have an opinion on as a voter, right? So we know that there's a presidential election. We know that there are federal elections and all of those. And when we get to city elections, the main thing to know is it's going to look a little different on your ballot, right? Instead of just filling in that one bubble, you're going to be able to fill in that one bubble for your first choice, your one bubble for your second choice, and so on. So I've seen a lot of elections where voters have, you know, the old way of doing elections and ranked choice voting on the same ballot, and they do just fine. But I think for voters, it's really, in those races, you have this opportunity to really weigh your options in a different way, right? So instead of adding in the layer of, okay, I have these choices, who do I really like? Who has a chance of winning? You kind of get to eliminate that who has a chance of winning and really just focus on those choices in city elections. I can't guarantee that up and down the ballot, but that is up to the voters. And maybe they're, you know, maybe you're super excited, however it may be. But in those city elections, that layer is going to be removed and you get to really look at the field of candidates, decide who aligns with your values and your priorities and rank them in order.
Well, if our listeners are interested in learning more about ranked choice voting, maybe generally, but also, of course, in the Portland context, are there resources that you'd recommend?
So if voters are looking for more information, they can go to www.portland.gov/vote.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to hopefully connect with as many Portlanders about the election as possible in the coming months. So I'm glad to start here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. That was Grace Ramsey from Democracy Rising. She's a national expert in ranked choice voting, and we spoke about this new election method that Portlanders will be taking